Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cagliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much.
Right. So in the past couple months, a number of states have passed fairly restrictive abortion legislation in an effort to at least restrict abortion access and potentially to overturn the Supreme Court decision in Roe versus Wade. We're thinking at some point in the future we may have an episode, we're probably going to have an episode that looks at the history of abortion and abortion rights. But this week we thought we'd look at how Supreme Court decisions get overturned. If you have a Supreme Court decision that you are not fond of, what's the process by which, what are the options that you have for overturning it? So we'll look at some examples from the past 200 years of Supreme Court decisions being overturned and then see how this sort of compares to the current moment and the current set of legislation in Alabama and
Georgia
and
Ohio,
and I think Missouri. Kentucky and Missouri. There's a number of places that have placed pretty substantial restrictions, heartbeat bills and other kinds of things.
I mean, I think one thing we should stipulate at the outset, David, which will become abundantly clear to our listeners, is we are not lawyers.
Yes.
And this is not necessarily one of our strong suits, but I think it is. It's vitally important. If you did civics, if you're old enough to have done civics in high school in the U.S., you would, the Supreme Court is the court of last resort. That's where things are ultimately adjudicated, we're told. But there are means by which Supreme Court decisions can be reversed and overturned, and that's what we want to concentrate on today.
Exactly.
So,
we are not lawyers. We are not either of us by training legal historians. So if we get the details of these things wrong or the legal doctrines slightly imprecise, apologies beforehand.
I think anybody who stuck with us through all these episodes, or even more than one,
recognize the severe limits to our expertise.
Our limits are well established.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll apologize preemptively.
Okay. So, lawyers listening, tell us if we get things wrong, because undoubtedly we will botch some of these things. Right. So, the Supreme Court doesn't generally like to overturn itself, right? So I guess the general principle to start off with is the idea of stare decisis, that the Supreme Court, when it makes a decision, likes to then sort of keep that decision whenever it possibly can.
Can you define stare decisis?
So stare decisis is the idea that you let the decision stand, that the decisions should not be capriciously overturned, even if you think that they are not necessarily the right decision. So the court tends to be fairly conservative in its jurisprudence, that the law works slowly and it evolves slowly in most cases. So, the premise essentially is that once a court has made a decision, that it should stick to the decision, and subordinate courts, so the courts of appeals and what have you, should abide by the standings, the rulings the Supreme Court has made in the past.
Well, and let's not forget that U.S. law is, to a large extent, based on common law,
right,
from England, and common law, the common law tradition, very much rests on precedent. It's all about precedent, and that's why stare decisis is so important. And so, precedent carries particular weight in that legal tradition. And as you say, courts have been very reluctant to overturn precedent, in part because there has to be some ultimate final decision on things. And the way the Constitution and the judiciary is designed and the way the judiciary operates is there are courts of appeal and there are various systems in place so that the Supreme Court can ultimately adjudicate controversial decisions or topics, and when they do, that's supposed to be it.
Yeah. So, if you listen to confirmation hearings, this often comes up in confirmation hearings, because they talk, when they get asked about previous cases, and they often get asked about
Settled law,
and they say, this is a precedent of the Supreme Court, and sometimes they say it's a precedent upon precedent, when they've got sort of subsequent decisions confirming and building upon the initial one. So the court is reluctant to overturn itself, because its legitimacy is built upon not doing that.
But there are ways in which the Supreme Court, or that Supreme Court decisions can be reversed. I don't like to use the passive voice, but I'm doing it deliberately here because there are different ways. So what are they?
There's kind of three main paths I think you can overturn a Supreme Court decision. One is you can have the court overturn itself, and we'll talk about, there's lots of famous examples of the court reversing itself and coming to a completely different decision than it did the first time. The second way is by incrementally sort of undercutting the original decision that will eventually lead to a new decision. So instead of flipping it, it sort of chips away at an original decision. And the third way is to go around the courts entirely and to amend the Constitution to change the law, right? If the Supreme Court's job is to interpret the Constitution, and they interpret the Constitution in a particular way, one option is to rewrite the Constitution so that the rules are different. And probably the best example of that is from 1793 in one of the earliest important Supreme Court decisions, and that's the case of Chisholm versus Georgia. Frank, this is your century, and tell us about Chisholm versus Georgia.
I will tell you about Chisholm versus Georgia. So I think his name was Alexander Chisholm.
That sounds right, yeah.
Sued the state of Georgia. Chisholm came from South Carolina, but he was the executor of the will of a man named Farquhar, or the estate of a man named Farquhar, undoubtedly of Scottish descent, yes, with that name. And Farquhar, whose first name escapes me, I'm sorry, was owed money by the state of Georgia. He was a Georgian. As a result of the War of American Independence. And so Farquhar was owed money by the state of Georgia. The state of Georgia did not honor that debt. And Chisholm, in 1792, the case was heard in 1793, sued the state of Georgia to get, as the executor of Farquhar's estate, in order to get this money back. And the state of Georgia contended that Chisholm had no standing to sue them. The Supreme Court ruled...
On the grounds that they are a state and therefore sovereign and therefore immune to a lawsuit.
Yes. And Chisholm won this case in 1793. The Supreme Court, which then had five members, voted 4-1 in favor of Chisholm and said the case could go ahead. So basically the Supreme Court said in 1793 that... Chisholm could sue, he had standing to sue the state of Georgia. In federal court, yes, in federal court. Yeah, thank you. As a consequence of this, the 11th Amendment was adopted. Dave, do you have the text of the 11th Amendment?
I can pull up the text of the 11th Amendment while we speak. 11th Amendment.
And so, basically, while David's doing that, just to sum up, I mean, the large point we're trying to make is Supreme Court decisions can be reversed by a constitutional amendment, although amending the Constitution is a very, very difficult and cumbersome process, and deliberately so. It requires supermajorities in both Congress and in the states in order to amend the Constitution, so it's very rare. What does the 11th Amendment say?
The text of the 11th Amendment, of course, this is not one that people tend to commit to memory the way people do.
Nobody's getting this on mugs and t-shirts.
Right. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed, thank you. I'm not so good with the reading. To extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against any one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state.
Okay, what does that mean in normal language, David?
It means you can't sue a state if you are from a different state or if you're from a different country.
Okay, can I just say, and I realize this isn't our main theme today, but David and I had a brief conversation about this before we started, and he knows my views on this are quite strong. I think this is incredibly stupid. I don't see why you can't sue a state if you're from either from that state or from another state or from another country. If the state of Georgia or the state of Massachusetts or the state of California has committed a crime against you or committed a transgression, you should have the right to sue them. David, don't even speak. So there are these 10th Amendment nutters who are 10thers. I'm going to become an 11th-er, and I'm going to devote the rest of my life to the repeal of the 11th Amendment.
But the 10th Amendment are people who want to uphold the 10th Amendment, and they want to sort of talk about the rights protected by the 10th Amendment, and just like the 2nd Amendment, people want to protect the rights. You want to overturn the 11th Amendment.
You with your facts.
Okay, so
the 11th Amendment is stupid.
Well, no, it's not stupid.
Make the case.
The case for sovereign immunity, which is sort of the origins of this, which has very deep roots in legal traditions around the world, is that a government, if it has sovereignty, if it gets can be sued by anybody, that can impede the ability of the government to do its job, right? If citizens of a state could then sue the state, and they had to deal with thousands of lawsuits per day that impinged upon their ability to do anything, that would make the government cease to function.
Okay, I understand that, and I think that's a legitimate concern, especially in the current political moment. One can imagine that, given the current politics of the United States, that such lawsuits would be quite common if there were no sovereign immunity. Having said that, surely there's a way to, a court could adjudicate these things and decide what cases have standing and would be allowed to go forward and which wouldn't.
Given how clogged the American court system is already, that would open up a sort of Pandora's box, though, potentially, of lawsuits.
Okay, I mean, let me... We need to move on because the larger issue we want to deal with today is how Supreme Court decisions are reversed. And so this is a case where it's a good example of what you were talking about, whereby the court made a decision and the American people and their political leaders amended
the Constitution. And mostly their political leaders.
Yeah, amended the Constitution in order to address this decision and to reverse this decision. That's a perfectly legal way to proceed.
Now, it doesn't happen very often.
It does not happen very often because amending the Constitution is really hard.
Really hard. And in this case, this is in some ways the first time the Constitution is really amendment, because if you think about the first 10 are put together as a package, this is the first one, that it comes after that once the government is up and running. It's interesting that's the first time that they use that particular mechanism, but it's a hard mechanism to use because of the procedures that are required to amend the Constitution. There are a few other times, though, where it does happen. One can look at, say, the 14th Amendment as overturning the Dred Scott decision from 1857. One of the things that... most people are familiar with the Dred Scott decision. This is the decision that's issued a few years before the Civil War, in which a enslaved man who was owned by a army surgeon was taken both into a free slave state and a free territory, sued for his freedom on those grounds. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney, issued this decision in which he said, among other things, that Dred Scott, this enslaved man, was not a citizen of the United States and not a citizen of a state, nor could any black man be a citizen of the United States, which is an interesting sort of legal creation on his part. One of the things the 14th Amendment does is it grants citizenship to all those people who are born or naturalized in the United States.
And in fact, that's where birthright citizenship comes from.
But that's a place where the Supreme Court had made a decision, and the remedy comes from outside the courts through the amendment process to change that. And obviously lots of other things have changed between Dred Scott and the 14th Amendment, most notably the Civil War and the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery. So the whole framework is different in lots of ways. But, that's probably the other sort of big example of the amendment process being used to deal with a Supreme Court decision that people weren't happy about.
So that is an unusual process.
Yes.
So it's not unusual. It's totally legal. It's laid out in the Constitution. It can be done.
It's just a challenging process.
It's a challenging process, yes. So it's only happened a few times. By comparison, I think the Supreme Court has reversed earlier decisions of the court 236 times, I think is the figure.
I've seen different numbers. I've seen 200, partly depends on how you count,
right.
But somewhere between 200 and 300 cases where the Supreme Court explicitly overturns previous decisions.
So despite our premise that about stare decisis and the court being reluctant to overturn previous rulings, it has done it on average about once a year. Now, over the course of American history.
Yes, yes.
It's been much more common in the 20th and 21st
century. Part because the court meets more often and there's more cases and whatnot.
Let's talk about hollowing things out for the second way before we...
But on the other hand, I think one per year. I mean, the court hears, I think, like 80 to 100 cases per year, and they overturn precedent in one of those. That's not a very high batting average.
That's right.
So I guess it depends on how you do the math. You know, so thinking about those 200 to 300 cases, in most times, the when the Supreme Court actually overturns that, there are decisions that they have made recently. They're somewhat more people have done this sort of the math on this have looked at and said the times the Supreme Court does overturn itself, it tends to do it pretty quickly, when the precedent hasn't set in very much, and when the part they realize they made a, oops, we messed up that one last year, we're going to fix it. And so there's a couple of cases you can think of where the Supreme Court changes its mind pretty quickly. Probably the one that comes to mind for me is Furman versus Georgia from 1972, when the Supreme Court ruled against the death penalty. That was a case where you had five of the nine justices say the death penalty was unconstitutional, although they didn't agree about exactly why it was unconstitutional. Some said it was capriciously applied. Some said it was inherently cruel and unusual punishment,
thereby violating the Eighth Amendment.
Right. And the Supreme Court, and so effectively there was this moratorium on the death penalty in the mid-1970s. And the Supreme Court then changes its mind in 1976 and says, actually, we've reconsidered this, and we do find that there are ways in which the death penalty could be constitutional and not cruel and unusual punishment.
In Gregg versus Georgia. And I think that's interesting with regard to the abortion question, because, first of all, it's approximately the same time period, but also what happened in Gregg versus Georgia is this court essentially said states can make the decision on this.
Yes.
And kind of, you know, the moratorium was lifted, or it more or less shifted the question to the states, which is why some states have the death penalty and use it fairly commonly or relatively commonly, and others do not.
Yes.
And so the moratorium is kind of a partial lifting of the moratorium, I guess, is one way to
Well, I mean, I think it lifted the national moratorium.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it sort of makes it, you know, states' right.
But it basically said the states could decide, and to some extent that's been the one of the themes in the challenge to abortion and the Roe v. Wade decision, which is also 1972.
Sure.
But anyway, we'll get there. So you're right. Most of the time when the court reverses itself, it really is literally reversing itself, in the sense that a court composed of many of the same people will reverse a decision they made a few years earlier. Yet the most famous cases, the ones that people remember, are actually the ones where there's a long gap.
Yes.
So probably the most famous is the 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education decision, which overturned the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. Mm-hmm. Plessy versus Ferguson enshrined segregation in law.
Yes.
And in, well, it was in practice, of course, but enshrined it in law and said separate but equal was legal.
So the background to Plessy versus Ferguson is that the state of Louisiana had a law that segregated railroad cars. Homer Plessy, the lawsuit, like many lawsuits that end up in the Supreme Court, was I don't want to say staged, but it was it was orchestrated to try to challenge this law. Homer Plessy was of mixed racial background. I think he was 7/8 white, but according to Louisiana law, he was classified as black. He buys a train ticket. He then tells the conductor about his racial demographics, I guess. The conductor tells him to move, and then when he doesn't move, he gets arrested for violating the state law. And they hoped in filing this lawsuit for the Supreme Court to rule that segregation was unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment protections of the Equal Protection. The Supreme Court ruled, however, in Homer versus Plessy that Plessy versus Ferguson, that that segregation was legal so long as the accommodations were equal. And this was the legal framework then for segregation, not only in railroad cars, but in everything else, in schools and hotels and restaurants.
So it establishes the separate but equal principle.
Yes. And of course, as everybody listening to this probably knows, the equal facilities were never equal, that the railroad car for African Americans was always inferior to the one for whites, the schools were inferior, so it sets up this sort of legal fiction of maintaining equality within the within a Jim Crow system that makes inequality inherently unequal.
And the court reverses that in 1954 with the Brown versus the Board of Education decision,
yes.
Which says, by definition, separate cannot be equal.
Yes.
And that leads to the desegregation of schools, or it's meant to, across the South and indeed the North as well, but particularly that's obviously a turning point in the history of the civil rights movement, because it's a major legal, well, it's a reversal by
yes.
the court. Yeah.
Yeah. And we have some other, you know, similar cases in civil rights law of a variety of kinds of the Supreme Court changing its mind and overturning its previous opinions. In Loving versus Virginia, for instance, they actually overturned, which is 1967, actually overturns an older precedent. The case that overturned was Pace versus Alabama from 1883. So it actually sort of predates Plessy versus Ferguson. In the Pace case, this was a case of interracial marriage that the state of Alabama said was illegal because they had a law against interracial marriage. And the Supreme Court said that kind of regulation by the state was entirely legitimate. And they only overturned that in, you know, almost a century later in Loving versus Virginia. The other example that comes to mind is the Bowers versus Hardwick case and the Lawrence versus Texas case from 1986 and 2003, respectively. And these are about sodomy laws. In Bowers versus Hardwick, it was a case involving two men who were arrested for violating state sodomy laws, and the Supreme Court said, no, those are perfectly legitimate for states to regulate sexual conduct between consenting adults. And then, you know, I guess 17 years later, in Lawrence versus Texas, they rule, in fact, that consensual behavior between adults was protected under the Constitution and throughout these discriminatory sodomy laws. So you do have, you know, some fairly pivotal cases where the Supreme Court does overturn itself in a fairly direct sort of way, where they say the last decision was wrong, we are overturning this decision for both legal reasons and sometimes for societal, cultural reasons.
Well, and in most of these cases that we've cited, when the court makes this decision, David, it seems to me that it's doing so with the intention of extending rights or extending, not quite phrasing this correctly, they're acting in the interest of extending the rights of citizens in most of these cases. So overturning Plessy versus Ferguson extends, or is about desegregating schools. The cases you talked, so the Lawrence versus Texas is about basically enshrining sexual privacy as a constitutional right, for example. The interesting, yet this mechanism exists. The court can decide what it decides, and given its current makeup, I think if one of these restrictive abortion laws comes before the court, and I think the intention, the reason these laws are so restrictive and so controversial is by design, because they want to challenge Roe v. Wade and they want the court to make a decision. And I think the governor of Alabama stated as such when she signed their law a month or so
back. Yeah, they're pretty explicit about what the purposes of these laws
and
are.
And so even the proponents of the law say, well, this probably goes too far, but they want the court to make a decision. My point being, sorry, I'm wittering on, but given the current makeup of the court, what we may see is a reversal that actually restricts rights rather than extends them. And that might be for the first time in a very long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things...
Would you agree with that?
I guess it depends on how one defines rights. Because, I mean, the other thing the Supreme Court has been doing a lot recently is, limiting the ability of both states and the federal government to regulate things like speech, like campaign donations, Citizens United, whatnot. So the question is, where does that fall in the rights category?
But sorry, I'm talking about overturning previous
decisions that's
as
true.
Opposed
yeah.
to issuing decisions that do that.
That's true.
So I'm talking just with regard to this particular question.
So you know, I think part of that is, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s and 1970s, so that, you know, during the when Earl Warren and then Warren Burger were chief justices of the Supreme Court, those were moments in which the Supreme Court became I don't want to say progressive institution, but more progressive than it had been. The Supreme Court had traditionally been a fairly conservative institution. And there's this moment in which the Supreme Court does take in a much more expansive view on the rights of the accused than it had previously. So there's a number of decisions, for instance, where the Supreme Court overturns previous decisions in the 1960s about the rights of the accused. Probably the most famous is Matt versus Ohio, which is about the exclusionary rule about evidence obtained without a warrant.
Right.
The Supreme Court had previously said, actually, if you obtain things without a warrant, you can probably use it. That's fine. And they overturned that case, which is Wolf versus Colorado. They overturned that in Mapp versus Ohio. So there's a moment, from 1950-something to 1970-something, which the court is relatively expansive in opening up new rights for people. And since then has been building on that in limited ways, when we can think about both the, Bowers versus Hardwick, but you can also think about sort of gay marriage as being sort of along that spectrum. Other than that, the past 20 years has been a fairly conservative moment for the Supreme Court and appears to be headed more in that direction over the next 20 years.
Probably.
Rest of our lifetime.
Yeah, I guess the point I was making was when it comes to reversing decisions, it's been to extend liberty, whereas I think you're right, they are constricting liberties in different ways in the decisions, both in the cases they choose to hear and the verdicts they render. But I think it's slightly different in terms of these reversals.
Well, it partially depends on how one defines rights. And I'll get the example I'm thinking of here is Lochner versus New York from 1905. And this was a case in which the state of New York placed limitations on the number of hours a person could work in a week. It was like 60 hours a week. So it was as restrictions on working hours go, by modern ears, that sounds outrageous. But anyway, so they did this limit. And this guy named Lochner, I think ran a bakery, sued saying this interferes with my freedom to contract however I want to with my employees. And the Supreme Court sided with Lochner. And there's a series of decisions that come after that where the Supreme Court limits Lochner or modifies it in slight ways. There's a case called Mueller versus Oregon from 3 years later in which the Supreme Court says it's okay to limit the hours for women because women are different and women need protection and all other kinds of sexist nonsense, but they made a distinction in that case. But eventually, in 1937, they overthrew Lochner, saying that, in fact, maximum hour legislation is constitutional. Now, I agree with the Supreme Court's decision in this later case, West Coast Hotel, personally, because I think it's good to limit people's hours and make sure they get minimum wages and all these other kinds of things. But one can make an argument there, in fact, that they are, if you think the freedom to contract is a real right, and I'm not sure that it is, that might be a case where they are limiting the rights of people to do things they want to do.
So that's a good example of, but I want to go back to the 11th Amendment, because I think this is...
So how, and I know
the answer to this, I think, but I think I do understand it. How was Lochner able to sue New York if New York had sovereign immunity?
Because once they prosecute you. So he was prosecuted for violating this law because he contracted for 65 hours or something. And so if you have he wasn't suing New York. New York was prosecuting him for violating the law, and then he appealed the prosecution.
Okay.
So it's
right.
So if they arrest you for jaywalking and it's the
so
state
you
of Mass.
You can sue them if they sue you.
Well, you can appeal. So
but also, I guess one of the answers I was looking to elicit, this is like a tutorial when you're
suing. Oh, geez. But I give you the right answer, even if it's not the right answer you were looking for.
Yes, you gave me the right answer, David. That's right. But it wasn't the right answer I was looking for, which is, of course, states can waive their sovereign immunity in a lot of cases to go forward. So that's important. We didn't talk about that when we talked about the 11th, but that's an important aspect of it. Okay, so the courts can reverse themselves and do reverse themselves. Certainly, it's more common for the court to reverse itself than it is to have a constitutional amendment. However, you mentioned a third way.
Well, so the third way, and sort of Lochner actually fits in with this pretty well, is the Supreme Court doesn't explicitly overturn itself, but then it qualifies its previous decision, right? And so in Lochner, they said, no, the state cannot place limits on the number of hours a person can work. And then 3 years later, they said in Mueller versus Organ, oh, that was from men. Women are different, and we're going to distinguish the case of maximum hour legislation for women. And then, you know, later there's some cases about child labor where they say, oh, the state has not an interest in protecting child labor that's different than for adult men. So there's ways in which they, the Supreme Court doesn't explicitly overturn its decision, but then it sort of puts shackles on it. And a similar thing, I think, has been happening with abortion rights. So, I mean, you have abortion rights established in Roe versus Wade. But since then, the Supreme Court has had other decisions on abortion that have put bounds on the right to access to abortion.
Right. So
the most important case here is Casey versus Planned Parenthood
in 1992. So it's 20 years after Roe v. Wade.
Right. And that in that decision, the Supreme Court said that states could regulate abortion, but not place an undue burden upon a woman's right to access to abortion.
So that reminds me a little bit of the Gregg versus Georgia case in 76 about allowing the states to regulate capital punishment.
Yes.
That's a crucial thing. The Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 92 is important, I think, because it does allow the states to make their own decisions within.
So the question then, of course, becomes what is an undue burden upon, and what's happened, since Casey is that states have been trying to sort of push that limit.
Some states,
right. And for those who, there's a whole landscape of abortion rights, the ways in which the access to abortion is different in different parts of the United States is radically different. And they've done things like introduce, waiting periods between when you make an initial appointment to when the procedure actually takes place. There's ones about having access to admitting privileges in hospitals. There's stuff about having certain surgical procedures, the regulations about the facilities where these abortions are going to take place to make sure that they have, there's one case where there was only one abortion clinic in the state, and they said that the hallways in abortion clinics had to be a certain width wide, and it was like 6 inches wider than the hallway in that one particular abortion clinic, and so there's ways in which they're trying to situate these things to see what the courts will allow them to get away with. And so, states are have been trying since Casey to create as many barriers as to abortion as they can within the bounds that the court has laid down for them.
So, David, you lived in North Dakota.
Yes, I lived in North Dakota, a state with only one abortion clinic.
Right. So, effectively, presumably there were restrictions on that clinic of the kind you're describing, or not?
There were restrictions in
North Dakota.
So there were restrictions in North Dakota, as many listeners know, is a very conservative state. And in some ways, in other ways, there's some progressive elements to its politics as well. But there was only one abortion clinic. It was in Fargo. It was actually not far from where I lived. The state tried at various points in time to place regulations upon that to effectively shut it down. They tried at one point to require that the doctors who practice there have admitting privileges in local hospitals. And the nearest local hospital was like a Catholic hospital, and they weren't going to give admitting privileges to abortion doctors. And so there's, ways in which the state was trying to find ways of making abortion illegal without explicitly making abortion illegal, to do it within the bounds that Casey laid out.
Okay, so the law, we've been talking about legal decisions, but this is... These decisions and the context in which they're taken is inherently political.
Oh, to be sure.
And it has been a political it has been an article of faith, and that's perhaps the right way to frame it, on the part of the right in the United States, but particularly the religious right, to overturn Roe v. Wade almost since 1972, but certainly since the 80s, since the rise of Reagan. And that's been really, really, it's been a key element of keeping the Republican coalition together.
And it was key to Trump's election.
Right, yes. So but let me finish. It was the key to Trump's election, in part because it meant that, or the way it's been interpreted is, the courts are really important. And frankly, the right has taken the courts more seriously and the judiciary more seriously. We've talked about this in the past, I think, than the left has in the United States because of this. And so it's been a really, really effective way to mobilize their supporters.
Mm.
However, if one wants to reverse Roe v. Wade, and so we're not talking about abortion itself now, I'm talking about the political aspects of this. It seems to me that what they're doing in terms of that third way, of the three options we've discussed, constitutional amendment, the Supreme Court overturning a previous decision, or effectively hollowing out and making the previous decision a dead letter, the last is the most effective for them. So let's assume, and I think this could well happen, that one of these onerous or quite restrictive state laws makes it to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. I actually think that might be a mistake. Again, I'm talking about politics here rather than the actual decision itself. Politically, that could be bad for the right, because this has been really good politics for them for a very long time. Mm. It's a bit like the dog catching the car, the dog that chases the car. Because what we'll see, I think, in consequence is a backlash on the left. And first of all, the left will take the courts as seriously as the right have for the past 40 years and pay attention at off midterm elections and so on. And there could be a reaction. What do you think of that?
I think there's some political calculus going on here. The alternative is that if Roe versus Wade gets overturned, and several, what will then happen will be that abortion will be legal in some states and not legal in others, is that conservatives can say, do you want to keep abortion illegal, or do you want to have an abortion clinic open up around the corner from your house? Right, yeah. And that can still be a very convincing argument in many conservative parts of the country to continue voting for conservatives. Now, I mean, one of the things that's happened in the past 2 years is the Trump administration, with the help of Mitch McConnell, has been amazingly successful at filling vacancies in the federal court system with very, very conservative judges.
Yeah, dozens.
I think it's like one-fifth of the federal judiciary has been appointed in the past 2 years.
And he was equally effective at blocking Obama's appointments.
Yeah, so they're part of the reason why there were so many empty slots is because Obama was largely prohibited from appointing people, especially in his second term. And so, you know, if the Supreme Court does make that move, figuring out exactly what's going to happen in the years that follow would be very difficult in terms of the political calculus of it. Now, I mean, thinking about what kind of decision the court would rule if, say, Georgia's law or Alabama's law or one of these other, you know, various laws reaches the court. Some court watchers have looked at Chief Justice Roberts and have said basically he's an institutionalist by nature, and that he would be loath to overturn cases because he just generally doesn't like overturning cases, that they would then simply, they'd find a way of maintaining Roe versus Wade in a sort of hollow way, but then sort of build on the Casey precedent by placing such severe limitations that it would be effectively overturning Roe versus Wade while still legally keeping it in place. I'm not quite sure I buy that analysis. I mean, the question with Roberts and with many of the other justices is how, you know, when they were questioned during their confirmation hearings, they all said, oh, Roe versus Wade is a precedent, it's an important precedent, it's a precedent upon precedent.
It's settled law.
It's settled law. you know, were they lying through their teeth when they said that, or were they, you know, sincerely articulating a view of how important stare decisis was as a principle?
Right, but if our discussion this afternoon has showed us anything, it's law is settled until it's not.
Well, to be sure.
So courts can change decisions.
Well, so I mean, one of the things, though, that's interesting about the ways in which the court change, you know, the court, when it makes these overturns decisions, they do so and they frame it in using legal arguments. But very often what's going on is that the court is reflecting changing public attitudes towards a topic, whether that's like, for instance, with gay marriage, when the Supreme Court ruled that gay marriage was a right protected by the Constitution, that reflected changing public attitudes towards gay marriage that had been evolving in the 10 years prior to that decision. With abortion rights, if you look at the polling from since Roe versus Wade, it actually hasn't shifted very much. And shifted surprisingly little given how important it is in American public discourse, that the majority of Americans approve of abortion rights, although they do approve of some restrictions on abortion rights. And that seems to be, you know, the percentage of people who are eager to have Roe versus Wade overturned has remained actually remarkably constant over the past 40 plus years. So there isn't that shift in public opinion in the way there is with some of these other decisions where the court reaches a new conclusion. I'm not sure how that was going to factor in it, when and if these cases reach the Supreme Court. Obviously, you know, one of the things that's pushing states to pass these laws is that there's been a change in the composition of the court such that they think there's a decent chance that Roe versus Wade could be overturned.
You know. That's right. And for so although it's a minority of Americans want Roe versus Wade overturned, they are particularly committed on this issue.
Yes.
And see it as a holy cause, really. And they do see an opportunity. And if President Trump is allowed to fill another vacancy on the Supreme Court, should one become available, then that would really make it more likely, I guess.
Well, that's the future, and that's not our field of expertise, so we will see what happens.
Yes, there are two fields. We're not lawyers, and we're not prophets, but listeners, you
we'd all that. Be we'd be wearing nicer clothes if we were either of those things. Right, so we will see how all this plays out. Right, so time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
I have a slightly peculiar last drop this week, David, which is this is for local listeners. Particularly our
hyper local listeners,
you know, including friend of the pod Rick, who's in the next office.
Exactly. Hi, Rick.
But anybody who is in Edinburgh, I am, as I intimated last week. Actually, I am likely to move in the next month, and so as a consequence, I'm doing a slight cull of my books. I have a lot of books both at home and in my office here at the university. And I'm getting rid of some of them, and I want them to find good, loving homes. I'm not they are completely free, but mostly history, but also some nonfiction, and now fiction is creeping in as well. But if you are interested in free books, you have to promise to give them a good, loving home and take care of them, but they are there for you for the taking. So if you're in Edinburgh and you're in the George Square area, drop by my office, room 00M28 in the William Robertson wing, doorway 4 of the old medical school, and I peruse my, not all of my books, they're on the
floor. There's a pile.
In a particular place, there's a pile you can look at. You can't come into my office and take anything, but there are books there, and I would love for you to come in.
Now, should people like email you first, Frank, so that you'll be there? Well, they break into your office.
Sort of like if you're coming from London,
exactly.
Make sure I'm going to be there. But if you're in the building, and I know we have listeners among our students, undergraduates and postgraduates, just drop
free,
by. And
free you can have free a, books.
Free books. Free books. So yeah, I love books. What is better than free books?
Yes.
So and you've looked at the pile. There's some
good
things
book.
There.
I even took some select items from the pile, but there's some other gems that are remaining that people should avail themselves of.
Excellent. So you're welcome.
Disseminating knowledge.
And there's no time limit on this in the sense that I'm constantly kind of replenishing that pile.
Okay.
So, drop on by.
Excellent. Excellent.
What about you, David? What's your last
name? So I want to...
I shouldn't have given my office number. Anyway.
It's online. They Google you. It's not like we have secret offices.
Yeah, it's true.
We may have secret offices. Those aren't online. But... Anyway,
if we had secret offices, we wouldn't tell you.
Exactly. I want to endorse an NPR podcast called White Lies, which is, I guess they're doing 6 or 7 episodes, and they're about 3/4 of the way through releasing these. It's a true crime, I guess that's the genre of podcast. This is looking at the murder of a Unitarian minister, civil rights activist in Selma in 1965, so right after the Edmund Pettus Bridge Bloody Sunday incident. This is somebody's murder subsequent to that. And they are trying to discover, sort of uncover the story of who murdered him. They've identified a few people who were involved. But it is one of these cases that's both about something that happened 50 years ago, but also about what's happening in this Alabama community now and how they're dealing with the legacy of these events from long ago.
How many parts is it?
I want to say it's 7 or 8, and they just released episode 5. And I think this is one of these true crime things where they actually have a narrative arc at the end, so it's not going to be like Serial where they throw up their hands at the end. Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know who did it.
Yeah. So I think, but it's really well produced. There's some good archival, audio from the 60s mixed in with interviews with contemporary people who are still around talking about this murder. So it's a really interesting, well done.
How long are the episodes?
Oh, they're like 45 minutes. So they're about the right size for these kinds.
That's
of
what we aim for.
Exactly.
All the good podcasts.
All good podcasts. Like, I followed our lead in that regard. All
Excellent.
Right, until next week.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.